We made it all the way through one book. These narratives are fun to preach through because you can move through them fairly quickly. We started in Matthew about the same time that we started into 1 Samuel, and here we are in the middle of Matthew chapter 9 on Sunday mornings, and we're already finished with 1 Samuel 31 in just about the same amount of time. So we're moving along pretty good as far as speed goes, getting through these historical books, but the lessons that we're drawing from them, I think, are invaluable, is to see how God works in the lives of his people. Because the way he worked then is the same, he's the same God today. And so there are great lessons for us to look into. And I can tell my father-in-law, it took him like 4 years to get through the book of Genesis. And so, who knows, maybe Matthew will take me another 3 years to get through. But so we're in 2 Samuel, chapter 1, as we continue our series of kingly lessons and look at David, the life of David. 1 Samuel chronicled the rise of the monarchy and the fall of Saul's dynasty because the writer is tracing the necessity of a Davidic king. Remember, he's writing this from the standpoint, if 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings are all one book, or written by the same person, which they probably are, you're looking at someone writing after the exile has happened, and he's chronicling the rise and fall of the monarchy, but he also is writing to point out the necessity of having a Davidic king, not some other line of kings. Even the book of Judges pushes this issue a little bit, because what do you see out of the Benjaminites in the book of Judges? Anybody recall any accounts of the Benjaminites in the book of Judges? Yeah, Levite was passing through Benjamin at one point with his concubine, and there nobody took them in, so they were very inhospitable. And not only that, when someone finally did take them in to spend the night so that they didn't have to spend the night out in the open on the street square, all the people of the town rushed upon it, just like it had happened to Lot and the angels in Sodom and Gomorrah. The people of this town in Benjamin rushed upon the house, banged on the door, and said, "Hey, bring this guy out. We want to have our way with him." So he put his concubine outside. They raped her repeatedly and killed her. And in the morning, he got up and cut her into pieces and sent her parts throughout the nation of Israel. And so that's the picture you get of Benjamin. It's not the best picture. Well, the first king of Israel, Saul, is from which tribe? Benjamin. There is something subtle going on behind the scenes here of tracing a contrast between the Benjaminite dynasty and a Davidic dynasty. So that even in the book of Judges, or during the period of the Judges, what biblical book takes place during the period of the Judges? Anybody know? Try to put your timeline together. It's a little short book in the Old Testament. 4 chapters, primarily talks about a young girl named Ruth. How does Judah play out, the tribe of Judah play out in the book of Ruth? Remember who the Judah person is in the book of Ruth? It's Boaz. Boaz welcomes Naomi and Ruth into his family, treats them well. He's good to his workers. He blesses his workers in the name of the Lord when he goes out to see them. He's generous with his possessions. And he is in the line of David. Thinking offhand, he's great-grandfather of David. And so you get, during the period of the Judges, Benjamin comes off looking not too good. They're not the obedient, law-keeping people in Israel of the time, but Judah turns out to be. So then you get your first kings, and the first king of Israel is Saul, and he's from the tribe of Benjamin, David from the tribe of Judah. So even in that historical context, they're building a case for a Judah king, not a Benjamin king. And so throughout the first book of Samuel, we have seen the rise and fall of King Saul. Because of his faithlessness and his disobedience to God's direct commands, Saul was rejected from being king. And at the end of the book, we see that come to fruition as he falls in battle upon the mountain of Gilboa in the northern part of Israel as he's battling the Philistines. The second book of Samuel is going to chronicle the rise of the Davidic dynasty in the kingdom. And so from the very beginning, we're going to see David's rule over Israel expand and grow. Now, by no means are we going to see David as a perfect person. We are going to see David, warts and all, in his life. We're going to see his failures. We're going to see his successes. But the failures do not negate the fact that God has chosen for Israel a Davidic line of kings, which ends, of course, in Matthew chapter 1, by tracing the line through Abraham and through David to the Lord Jesus. He is the end. He's the fulfillment. He's the perfection of the Davidic line. He's the son of David. And so important things to trace through those books. So we get the 2 Samuel chapter 1, entitled tonight, Liabilities and Laments, as we'll see what's going on here. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. So just to remind ourselves of where we're at, the battle with Saul was taking place up here in the northern part of Israel in this greenish valley called Jezreel. It's a nice flat spot. Jezreel is flagged by two mountains. Mount Gilboa here is on the south side of the valley, and that's going to play an important part in the narrative this evening because that's where Saul dies. He's on the mountain, Mount Gilboa, up here in the northern part. David is still down here at Ziklag. He has rescued his family from an Amalekite invasion, and he's brought them back to Ziklag, and this first verse tells us that he's been there for 2 days. So he's just fairly freshly returned from this foray into the Negev to rescue all of his people from the Amalekites. And he gets home, and he's been there for 2 days, and something happens on the third day. On the third day, behold. Again, that word behold tells you this is something to pay attention to. This is something important. A man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. This is a spectacular event, just because David probably did not get all that many visitors like this in his town of Ziklag. You can see on the map, Ziklag's down here in the south. It's towards the border of the Negev, this southern region that's very uninhabited, not very hospitable down there. And David's town is on the border between Philistia and Israel. So it's not a great place to live. This isn't, as they say in real estate, a key component of buying a good piece of property is location, location, location. This doesn't have location, no matter how nice the place. Of course, it's not very nice because the Amalekites burned it to the ground just about a week ago. But here's David. They're trying to rebuild it. They've been there for 2 days, and behold, a man shows up looking for David. This guy has come here purposely. Okay. So, it's also interesting that David has been home for 2 days, and it would probably take somebody just about 2 or 3 days to make the journey from Mount Gilboa down south to Ziklag. So that gives us a little bit of a time frame that David probably was going on his excursion to the Amalekites right about the time that the battle was happening, almost to the day, up in the northern part of Israel. So God had worked things out so that David would not be there to take Saul's life one way or the other. He wasn't there to help the Philistines. He wasn't there to get involved in the battle at all. God has miraculously and sovereignly kept David's hand from being involved in any way with Saul's death. That's going to be important. Because normally speaking, at the change of a dynasty in the ancient world, you almost never had a change of dynasty without the first dynasty being completely wiped out by the second. That's about the only way you could get it. So if Patricia wanted her dynasty to sit on the throne instead of Wanda's, there'd have to be a battle. And you know who would win? We don't know. Patricia says Wanda would have it. Yeah. Are you saying Wanda's mean? No. Oh, I know, I know. I'm just teasing you. I get myself in trouble when I just grab names out of the audience like that, don't I? I have to be careful about that. So it's an important piece of the narrative that tells us God has withheld David from being anywhere near that battle. Because what is going to be established here, not only in that detail, but also as the rest of the chapter goes on, is that David was not involved in the death of Saul in any way. In fact, he's going to lament it very seriously here in just a little bit. So that establishes the righteousness of David in being a man who wasn't seeking this position for himself. God anointed him to be the king. But several times throughout his life, David himself has refused to take that matter into his own hands and take Saul's life. David is a righteous man. He's not going to extend his hand against God's anointed king to try and place himself in that same position. And so here we are, 2 days later, third day, man comes from Saul's camp with clothes torn and dirt on his head. This is a position of mourning. It's a position of great distress. This guy is visibly displaying the anguish of what has happened to him, and it is on purpose. They still do this, by the way, over there. If some great momentous event happens, they will grab their shirt and tear it a little bit and pick up dust and throw it in the air, and they'll scream. Now, we European-descended people are usually a lot more calm and stoic than that, so we internalize all of our emotions, and we tend to think that people that express their emotions extremely like that are out of control. Well, it's not necessarily the case. So these people are very, very expressive with their emotions, and one of the ways that they'll do that with distress is to tear the clothes and to throw dust on the head as a sign of great distress. So this man arrives to David in this state of distress, and of course, David says to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Now here we're going to begin this new section in the text. So the first section was just introductory material as we looked at where David was and some of the timing. But now, the second section we're going to call, "You have the right to remain silent, dot, dot, dot." Okay? And what happens if you don't exercise your right to remain silent? That'll be the next section. Okay. But first of all, this man would have the right to remain silent in any of our court systems, but he's not going to exercise it. So David obviously wants to know where you've come from, what are you doing here looking like that. Something distressful has happened, and David wants to know what it is. And so he says, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Well, remember, David has not Facebooked or FaceTimed anybody from the northern region yet. He's out of cellular service being down there in the wilderness. He's not getting a good signal. And so, no text messages, no video chats, no emails about what went on at Mount Gilboa. This is the first he has heard about the battle. And what does this report tell you? Just those few simple words, "I have escaped from the Israelite camp." Yeah, that's not going well. If you had to escape from something, it's generally not a good thing, because good things you don't try to escape from. You try to stay there. So if you're trying to escape, that tells you things went bad. So David gets this first report of things going badly at the battle. And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." You could hear the urgency in his voice as he wants to know what's happened up there at the battle. And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead." Bad enough. That news right there, if you stopped, is terrible news. Israel's been defeated by the Philistines, their mortal enemy. But this guy doesn't stop. He keeps going. Because look at what else he says. "Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Now, how's David going to react to this? Well, it's not fair to ask you guys. You already know the story, don't you? But how would we react to this? How would you react to the news that Saul is dead? You mean the guy that's been chasing me my whole life? The guy that threw spears at me? The guy that stole my wife away from me and gave her to someone else? The guy that's made me flee and hide out in the wilderness for the last 6 or 7 years? The guy that's tried to kill me on several different occasions? The guy that I refused to kill? He's dead? Now, this might be the point where you pull out the little party poppers and start screaming, God has granted me deliverance. Finally, my enemies are gone. But now, how would you react to the news Jonathan's dead? This is your best friend. This is a man that has supported you. This is a man that was willing to give up his position and title, his claim to the throne, in order to make sure that you would gain it. And he's dead. This has got to be a mix for David, but also add into this fact that David is not a man that's going to rejoice over the defeat of his enemy. He loved Saul. Despite Saul's years of tormenting David and chasing him, David has loved Saul. He was fiercely loyal to Saul. So this is a difficult bit of news for David to hear. Then David said to the young man, he's going to begin a little bit of a trial, but he wants to find out, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? This is an important bit of information. Fairly easy to determine that Israel has been defeated before her enemies. Obviously, you ran here to get to me because you made it quick. 3 days from the northern end of Israel to the southern end is a pretty fast trek. So, okay, I can easily believe your account that Israel has been defeated. I mean, a very quick glance at the battlefield would tell you which way Israel is moving, whether it's toward the battle or away from it, and how quickly they're doing it. However, to know for certain that Jonathan and Saul are dead, you're going to have first-hand information. So David pushes on this detail a little bit. How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? Now here is where this man should have exercised his right to remain silent. But he's got a whole other agenda going on here, which we'll see as he builds his case. The young man who told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa." Baloney. You were there for a reason. Now later on, we're going to find out who this guy is. Anybody remember who he is? Not quite a bodyguard. He's an Amalekite. What did Saul do to the Amalekites? What's that? He killed a lot of them, yep. What did he do with some of them? Yeah, he saved some of the best. Remember, we have one specifically mentioned, Agag. We saw in Sunday school that when you get down to the book of Esther, Haman is an Agagite, probably a descendant of Agag, the king, whom Saul refused to kill. So Saul, it's highly likely that Saul preserved the royal court, not just Agag, but also some of the servants of the royal court, some of the courtiers, some of the best people, and brought them into his own court. So what's this Amalekite doing on Mount Gilboa, surrounding right near Saul? It's because Saul had brought these Amalekites into his royal court and had them in the battle with him. It's probably not the best tactical decision. But what's just happened with David and the Amalekites? They just burned his town. They just captured his wife and children. They just captured all the people that were in Ziklag, David's people. So David, probably not very well disposed toward the Amalekites right now. Maybe not the best thing this guy could have said just then, right? But he hasn't revealed that he's an Amalekite yet, but he will here pretty soon. "But by chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa." No, you were part of this battle. You were there for a reason, but you're holding back on that. "And there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called to me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." This entire story is designed by this Amalekite to ingratiate himself in David's sight. He wants David to bestow some favors upon him for what he's done here. And several things tell us. So one of the details that he notes for us first, you know, I just happened to be there on the mountain. Why were you on the mountain? Because you're a captured Amalekite. You're one of Israel's enemies, but you're going to leave that part out until later. And there I see Saul leaning on his spear. So he's already impaled himself, according to this man's story. And the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. I didn't want Saul to be captured alive. That would be really bad. So I did what only a noble warrior would do. And I obeyed his request and I killed him. Because obviously it'd be better for your king to be killed by one of us than it would be to be killed by the enemy, right? Wait a second, you're an Amalekite. Which side does that put you on? This guy's telling partly the truth, partly not, because he's trying to ingratiate himself in David's sight. If you go back to the previous chapter, there is a detail that's mentioned that tells us this Amalekite is making some of this stuff up. Part of it rings true, part of it doesn't. Okay? And so if you go through to verse 4, Saul said to his armor, I'm sorry, chapter 31, verse 4. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it. Sorry, I lost my spot. Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead. Okay, so first detail. Let's turn back to 2 Samuel 1. By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. Did he fall on a spear, or did he fall on a sword? He fell on his sword. And when he fell, what happened to him? He died, and the armor bearer saw him die. And it terrified the armor bearer so much that the armor bearer killed himself. Now, what are the chances that an armor bearer doesn't know the difference between a wounded man and a dead man? Do you remember what Jonathan's armor bearer did in the battle when he and Jonathan went up to the Philistine camp and started attacking people? Remember what happened in that battle? Jonathan went ahead and knocked him down. And what did the armor bearer do? He finishes him off. Okay, that's one of this guy's jobs. First job, protect the king. Make sure nobody gets at him. Second job, the king's going to be busy knocking enemies down. You've got to finish them off for him. Make sure they don't go back up. So how important is it for you as an armor bearer to know the difference between a wounded soldier and a dead soldier? Pretty critical. So what are the odds that the armor bearer mistook Saul for simply being wounded and mistook it so badly that Saul is able to have a somewhat extended conversation with this Amalekite just a few minutes later? Probably not. So you got two options here. The fun thing is that this scripture doesn't really ever clear this up. Is the guy telling the truth or is he making it up? Well, he's making up some of these details because the account given us in chapter 31 gives us some different details. But at the same time, David is going to accept this story as presented and use it against the man. So he's got a few of the details wrong. Saul was not leaning on a spear. He fell on a sword and he was laying on the ground. And he had died fairly quickly. And so what this man is telling David is a confession. Yeah, I killed the king, but it was all for good reason. I killed him because the enemy was coming and we're going to get him and torture him. Well, the enemy wasn't going to torture him. He was already dead. So why would this guy confess to have killed King Saul? Well, what better way to ingratiate yourself with the next king than to confess to him, yeah, you know, I really helped this whole thing come about for you. I'm going to help you get this promotion because I'm the one that finished off the king before you. And under normal circumstances, that would be a way to gain a promotion under these dynasties. Except this Amalekite doesn't realize he's dealing with a righteous man. He's dealing with a man that would never have lifted his own hand against King Saul. What do you think David would have done if he found Saul wounded, laying on the battlefield, and seeing the enemy rushing upon Saul? Probably you're right. David would have jumped into that battle and defended Saul till David was dead. What's this Amalekite say he did? Ooh, the brave and honorable thing. I euthanized King Saul for you, right? I killed him because he was already dead. And he's going to reiterate this here in just a minute. He said to me, stand beside, this is verse 9, Saul said to me, stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. So what he's saying is, David, I saw Saul. He's obviously going to die very soon. I just went ahead and hurried it up for him. Well, that's okay, right? I mean, after all, if you see a horse trapped in a burning barn and there's no way to get him out, what are you going to do? You're going to shoot the horse. Does that apply to people? Does God ever give us the right to take a life in this way? No, he doesn't. God alone has the right to decide when life can be taken and when it can't, and he has given us very detailed explanations of when it is legitimate to take another life. And euthanizing is not one of them. So when Terry Schiavo was on the machines down in Florida, alive, with the help of those things, what do you do? I'm not going to say these aren't tough decisions. But David does not accept this explanation that Saul was near death and therefore it was okay to kill him. Look at what he continues on here. That's the angle this Amalekite's trying to take. So he was going to die anyway, so I just went ahead and finished it off for him. And on top of that, I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. Here would be another amazing gift under normal circumstances. And I say normal to say what usually is, not what should be. He brings the royal jewels to David. The crown that sat on Saul's head and some decorative armor that Saul would have had. These would have been key tokens, and if the Amalekite had let those fall into the Philistine hands, like the body of Saul, they would have been treated as trophies. It's also telling that this Amalekite has more concern over these trinkets than he did over Saul's own body, that he was willing to take these trinkets to protect them when he wasn't willing to protect Saul. So he brings those to David, hoping again that these will be a token to ingratiate himself in David's sight. And I've brought them here to my Lord. So there the man has given his story. He has not exercised his right to remain silent. We're going to see how that works out for him. And David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David, in a very public and demonstrative way, shows that this is not what he wanted. He did not want Saul's life to end this way. He's mourning over this violent and terrible way for Saul to end his life. Because again, as we've said throughout Saul's life, the right answer, Saul, would have been repent. Turn away from this, confess it, forsake it, and God would have been merciful. You still had been rejected from being king. God doesn't turn away from those things. But you could have ended your life in a right relationship with God. Things could have ended quite a bit differently, but he refused to turn away from his sin. That's not what David wanted. David did not want this guy to end this way. And so when he finds out this is how Saul ended his life, he goes into mourning him and all the people that are with him. This is demonstrating again David's righteousness, David's compassion even for his enemies. David loved Saul. He didn't want him to die. He wasn't seeking the kingdom at the expense of Saul's life. Well, what's the next phrase after you have the right to remain silent? I know, none of you know this real well because it's never been uttered to you, and that's a good thing, right? But you've seen the crime dramas on the TV. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. That's David's next step. Look at what he says to the man. David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." Again, probably not the best thing you could have told David right then, 3 days after he returned from recapturing all of his family and possessions from the Amalekites. David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" With that one simple question, David completely turns this entire account around. What the man intended to present to David as a gift, "I gave you this great gift, I eliminated your enemy, and here's his crown." I mean, what better thing to give you a claim to the throne? Everybody knows you're going to be the next king, David, so I just helped you out. And here's the crown, so you can put it on your head, by the way. It's okay, you can thank me later with lands and low taxes and things like that. But what this man intended to be a gift to David, almost as a bribe to David, David turns around immediately and points out to him, how were you not afraid to destroy the Lord's anointed? What could have made you not respect that? How is it you could have possibly lifted your hand to kill Saul when God's anointing oil was upon him to be king? Did you not think of that? And obviously, the man is probably standing here a little dumbfounded, like, "Oh, wait, what's going on here? I just gave you this great gift, and now you're accusing me." "Yes, I'm accusing you," David says. Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, David didn't say this after he died, by the way. This is restating David's condemnation. He's already given it to the guy, and then he executed him. But we're hearing the condemnation after the execution because this is David's justification for using capital punishment. Okay. David had said to him, "Your blood be on your own head, because your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" So to David, stretching out your hand against the Lord's anointed, that was enough to condemn you to death. You don't touch God's anointed king. And on two different occasions, David himself had refused to do such a thing because Saul was God's anointed king. And do you remember what David said the second time? His men were encouraging him to kill Saul again. And David said, "No, his day will come. Either he'll perish from a sickness or from old age, or he'll die in battle. But God's going to take care of this." And so this Amalekite comes along. And David says, "You didn't let God take care of this. You took this into your own hands, and you're guilty. You deserve to die." And he has the man executed. So all throughout this first part of the account, David is showing himself to be completely innocent of Saul's death. He didn't want it. He didn't arrange it. He didn't have any part in it. And he's punishing the person that did have a part in it by executing him. The last half of the chapter transitions to a lament that David writes for Saul and Jonathan. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said, "It should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written the book of Jashar." That is a book that no longer exists as far as we know. It's quoted a couple of times throughout the Bible. And so apparently the historians that put together the books of Samuel had it available at the time. And it was well known, but we don't know what it is. We don't know where it is. Apparently, God didn't see fit to preserve it for us, except small portions of it that are quoted here and there throughout our Bible. But David wrote this psalm, and he taught it to the people because he wanted them to lament Saul. Now, remember what we're coming off the end of. This is 40 years of Saul's reign, and has Saul's reign been a good one or a bad one? For the land, pretty good. Yeah, because look at what Saul has done. He's expanded Israel's borders. He has secured them from the enemy. He's done what a government is supposed to do, protect its people. Now, from a spiritual standpoint, how has the time been? So we'll take Kim's nodding of her head saying, "Yeah, it's been pretty good." And we'll take Eldon's shaking of his head saying, "No, it's not been very good." And you're both right. Isn't that amazing? Now, from a political standpoint, it's been pretty good. Saul has done what a king is supposed to do. From a spiritual standpoint, no, it's not been very good because Saul has been disobedient. And some of the things that he has disobeyed the Lord on have made life a lot harder for his people. And yet, Look at what David is going to do in this psalm. Verse 19, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places." Your what? Your glory. Who's the glory of Israel then? Who's he talking about? Saul. Saul is the glory of Israel? And we might say, now David, are we talking about the same guy here? Guy that refused to kill the Amalekites? Guy that refused to wait for the sacrifices? David says, yeah, he's the glory of Israel. He was something good in Israel. He was something that benefited Israel. And now he's slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Let the daughters of the Philistines, or lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. So the first part of this psalm focuses on, don't let this get around. Don't let it be publicized and well known that Saul's gone, because this is bad for Israel. Saul was the glory of Israel. He was something good in it. He brought benefit to the people simply by virtue of being God's anointed. I was talking to a man some years back about elections and political things, and said, my goodness, what happens if we get some people in office that just really don't fear God at all? And what's our country going to look like? And he said, any government is better than anarchy. And I had never thought about it that way. But to say government is something ordained by God to preserve society, and so even the worst of governments is better than no government at all. Because imagine mankind completely unrestrained. What would that look like? Well, we know what's in the heart of men. We know what it would be like if mankind were completely, completely unrestrained. It wouldn't be pretty. And so even the worst of governors is better than none at all. And so David's focusing on a similar angle and saying, Saul, you brought benefit to Israel. Despite his failings, Saul was the glory of Israel. He was something good. So don't publish it around, especially in our mortal enemy's capital city. Don't let them know about it, or they're going to throw parades and they're going to throw parties, and the young girls will be dancing through the streets throwing confetti with big banners that say, yay, yay, Saul's dead. Or, you know, maybe the cheerleaders will think of something a lot more creative than that when they're shaking their pom-poms and celebrating Saul's death. But he says this would be extremely bad for Israel if Gath and Ashkelon and the Philistines get to celebrate because of Saul's death. That's not going to be good. You mountains of Gilboa, second section of this psalm, he's going to pronounce a curse upon the place of Saul's death. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, no fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. So he calls down this curse, let no dew or rain be upon you, which is an obvious reference to if there's no rain, then things are not going to grow. But then he says, nor fields of offerings. What does he mean by that? What's that? Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Because in David's estimation, if I grow a field and I take the first fruits of that and the tithe of that and I offer them to God, that's a blessing just to be able to offer that. Just to be able to take that portion and say, this is what God has given me. So the fact that nothing's going to grow there, what David focuses on is not that, oh, we're not going to have the increase of that. What David focuses on is, we're not going to be able to give an offering from this place. That's the curse that he brings upon it. This place should not bring an offering to God any longer because it allowed Saul to die upon it. It allowed Saul to be slain there. The shield of the mighty was defiled. Defiled with what, do you think? Blood. The blood of Saul on the shield that was supposed to protect him as a sign that it failed to do that. Not anointed with oil, so that if you have a weapon like that, you have to keep the thing clean and polished, otherwise it'll rust. And so in battle, you take your sword in and you use it, and when you're done, you'd better clean it off and polish it up, or it'll corrode on you pretty quickly. And so here is this picture of Saul's shield laying covered in his own blood upon the mountains, not being cleaned up. And David calls down this curse upon the mountain of Gilboa for allowing Saul to be killed there. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Does this sound like a lament for the disobediences of Saul? He's praising them. He's praising them for their virtues and saying, Saul, one of the things that he did well throughout his entire rule as the king was to defend Israel. He was a mighty man. He was strong. He fought the battles of the Lord. He defeated the Lord's enemies. He protected his people, and that was one of the things that he was supposed to do. And so David focuses on those good things and praises Saul and Jonathan for those traits. Notice that what weapon does he attribute to Jonathan in verse 22? The bow. Do you remember how Jonathan told David that Saul was after his life? I'm going to shoot the arrows. If I shoot it past you, that means everything's bad. If I shoot it in front of you, that means everything's good. So we see Jonathan must have been a very good archer because he's praised for his skill in battle with it, and we see it used in his life. Now, what weapon does he attribute to Saul? The sword. Returned not empty. That again, that signification that when Saul came back from battle, his sword was covered in blood. The blood of his enemies. It didn't come back empty. And so David, praising Saul and Jonathan for their prowess in battle. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and death they were not divided. What a testament to Jonathan's loyalty to his dad. Because throughout all that time, despite the fact that Jonathan had to rebuke his dad a couple of times for his unrighteous actions toward David, Jonathan never left his father's side, never turned against him. So that even though Jonathan knows that it's not Saul's son that's going to be the next king of Israel, it's David. Jesse's son is going to be the next king of Israel. Even though Jonathan knows that, Jonathan goes to battle right alongside his dad and defends him. Until he can't defend him any longer. Swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. Next section of the psalm calls upon the entire nation to enter a time of mourning. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. So what else did Saul apparently do for the country? He brought in money. He brought in prosperity. He brought in some financially good times so that the people were able to adorn themselves in these fine apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. This last section of the psalm is going to focus on Jonathan alone. Because as much as David was loyal to Saul and as much as he loved him, David loved Jonathan as a brother. David, Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. I'm not really sure how David's wife felt about this psalm, but there it is. Saul and Jonathan were Howard Ann of Green Gables. What was that word? Kindred spirits. These two were inseparable. So as far as their loyalty to each other. And he finishes off this lamentation with a repeat of the refrain that he's used several times, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. It's not exactly an encouraging psalm. It never resolves to anything remotely like encouragement. It stays focused on the loss that Israel's going to experience because of Saul's death. But throughout this whole first chapter, here's David showing himself that he has not taken things into his own hands to seek the kingdom for himself. He was completely allowing God to supervise events to bring about what God promised would happen. Never once did David take it into his own hands, even to the extent of saying, when Saul does die, I'm not even going to be happy that it happened, because this was God's man. Even though he was disobedient, even though he didn't do everything he was supposed to do, this was the man God set on the throne of Israel. And look at the benefits he conferred upon his people. Secured their borders, protected the people. He brought prosperity to them. And David laments his passing. That is going to set us up for what's going to happen in the rest of the book as David rises to power. The time of David's sojourning and his exile are over. And all of those years of preparation, all of those years of God shaping him while he hides out in the wilderness of En-Gedi and the Negev, are going to come to fruition as God places David on the throne. And David is showing himself to be the kind of king that is after God's own heart. Even in this last part of saying, I'm not going to rejoice in the death of this man. Even the scriptures even tell us God doesn't rejoice in the death of the wicked. Even when he brings condemnation out of his holiness and his justice, it doesn't delight God to bring judgment. He delights to show mercy. And so here's David exhibiting those characteristics as he deals with his, up till this point, his greatest enemy, Saul, who sought his life so many times. Any questions or comments about anything in this chapter?